Blog Talk Radio.
Do you think they really ready for you now? Do you think that there'll be many of you now?
Be loved in return. his voice. They say he wanders very far over many lands and seas. He was very shy, and there was so much sadness in his eyes. But there
charismatic and all that. He just was. Even when he sung the national anthem, I mean, it was Marvin Gaye. You know, it was just unique. It was special.
Can you see
you're about to see and hear, should you be so foolish as to have just joined us, is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. 3, 4.
I got something, yo, in
my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to
sing along.
Lift every voice and sing, till it in heaven ring. Ring with the harmony, oh, let it be. Let our rejoices rise high. Loud as the Georgia.
Partners in Community Building focuses on credit building, financial literacy, and home ownership for residents throughout Chicago and Illinois. All of our services are free. Call 312-328-0873 to get additional information on our homeownership counseling, rental assistance, Cook County foreclosure mediation, and small accessible repairs for seniors programs. PCIB is a HUD-certified nonprofit counseling agency committed to addressing the housing needs of all people. Call 312-328-0873 to schedule an appointment or visit us at www.pcibchicago.org.
For true inspiration, check out singer, songwriter, and radio personality Sylvia Fedrick. Sylvia, your sister under God's construction, brings to you her best in Christian contemporary gospel tunes, and they are available for download at www.sang.com. That's SANGSYL.com. Or you can visit her profile at Chicago Black Business Network. For bookings, call Sassy Michelle at 512-914-4221.
Want to learn the secrets of the wealthy? Do you think that the wealthy sell their gold and silver, or do they buy gold and silver? Learn to create wealth, collect wealth, and preserve wealth for you and future generations. Find out how you can acquire free silver every month. Visit goldandsilverplan.com. That's goldandsilverplan.com. What you don't know can keep you struggling financially. What you know can change your life. Be in the know. Visit goldandsilverplan.com today.
Hey, you want more money in your pocket, right? Savers are losers, unless you save like the rich and beat inflation. The secret? Save the right kind of money. Pure, solid, 24-karat gold or silver for as little as 20 bucks a week, direct from the mint. Don't spend money. Exchange bad money for good money. Start today at SaveMetalMoney.com. That's SaveMetalMoney.com. The chains of slavery in the modern world are not forged with links of iron, but with the bonds of limiting ideas and debt.
Be in business for yourself, but not by yourself. Team up with a company voted the 57th most promising by Forbes. With no money to collect from your customers, no credit checks, and no cost for you to join. Visit electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288. That's electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288.
Hi there, I'm the X-Man, Xavier Paul. I'm a national network voiceover talent. You've heard my voice represent hundreds of brands and businesses for the past 15 years. Well, now it's your turn. I understand how important it is to promote your business or event in the right way. That starts with quality radio spot production and the nation's top voiceover talent. You might wonder, how do I get started? What's the best approach? What voice talent do I use? And most importantly, can I do it affordably? That's why I created CoolVoiceRadio.com. I take you to the finish line, giving you everything you need to advertise effectively on the radio. I'll help you create your concept, write your spot, even choose your music and cast your voice talent and get it aired on the radio. Now that's cool. Email me today at info@coolvoiceradio.com or call 646-326-7800 because nothing beats the right sound.
What's going on, everybody? This is Jimmy Lee's Underground Radio Network, and we are now in full effect. I'm proud to have on my show today a marauder, a centurion, a friend of mine, Michael Blue Williams. Now, everybody said he got friends and people, they know people. You know, well, it's good to know people. You know, it's good to know people. And then I was just happening to just go through my little news clippings and stuff like that. And then I looked and saw Mike Blue Williams, Guns for Greatness. I'm like, Mike Blue Williams, Guns for Greatness. So I go on there, and I saw my cat, Mike, you know, big industry music mogul. You know, he brought CeeLo, brought Goody Mob, brought a whole lot of people out there for you to the industry, doing big things. And, you know, everybody might be proud of him for that. All the Marauders might be proud. Like, yeah, my man Mike, you know what I'm saying? He be knowing places, man. You go with Mike, you go here, you go there, and all like that. But this was makes me proud of my man Mike Williams. You know, and that is doing something to prevent something. Now, what do you mean, Jimmy Lee? You talk, you double talking, doing something to prevent something. What do you mean? He is providing mentoring or mentorship to at-risk youth. He's enlisting all his musical stars and celebrities to join him in this endeavor. And that's why I'm proud of him. Not of who you know, because everybody knows somebody. You know, everybody knows somebody. Everybody plugged. You know, I ain't saying that like it ain't hot. But everybody's plugged. But to use your plug to get people on is what I really appreciate him for doing. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to just play you a little of my man Mike Williams. I was trying to load up. That's what I'm stalling right now. I was trying to load up the program I saw with Rachel Maddow, which I was proud of him for that. But I couldn't get that loaded up quickly. So what I'm going to do is go for my man Mike going to be becoming a manager. And I'm gonna deal with that. And then when I get my man on the line, I had him on early, but I dropped him. When I get him back on, we're gonna deal with the Guns of Greatness. Why he decided to go for the Guns of Greatness? What was it that made him decide to use a celebrity for something good, for the greater good and greater cause? So let me bring a little pseudo clip of my man Mike Williams on becoming a manager. Then I'm trying to find something on this Guns of Greatness stuff. You know, please give me Mike. I'm trying to get everything uploaded now and try to get you the same.
To become a manager, there's many different ways. Some people start by, like, be interns at a management company, an entertainment company. Some people may meet an artist, and the artist will bond with them, and they'll like, I really believe in you, and I want to try and get you a deal. So sometimes that's how the relationship forms. Sometimes it's an artist, they might be the most intelligent friend that an artist knows, so the artist will approach them like, yo, you've always been good with business, or you're good with stuff that I'm not good at, and that's how it'll start. If you're just somebody, like, at home, and you're like, hey, I want to be in the music industry and I want to be a manager, first thing I would tell you is to get educated about the music industry, because as a manager, you're responsible for the business side of it. So pick up some books, read, educate yourself so that you can educate your artist when he comes to you with questions. Go to seminars. You could also go to, if you're trying to find talent, you can go to showcases. You can go to open mic nights. You can search the web and, like, see people's websites and just search until you find an artist that maybe excites you, and then approach them, find out if they have a manager. Tell them, just like, I really believe in you, and I want to get out there and shop a deal for you. So there's a number of different ways to slide in as a manager. A manager's main qualities are being intelligent, people skills, communication skills. A good manager, to me, needs to be able to sometimes see around the curve of what's coming. Managers need to be able to translate lingo. They need to take it from artist speak, as I like to say, to label speak, so the label understands it, and then from label speak to artist speak. So they need to be able to do that. They need to have planning skills, time management. A good manager needs to be able to do budgets and be able to really coordinate logistics of where your artist is going to be, how they're going to get their timing, things of that nature. And communication. This communication is very big, because you have to communicate with a lot of people. And as a manager, you're not just representing yourself, you're representing your client. So you have to be able to sound intelligent and get your ideas across and be articulate. A manager's job is to deal with all the political issues and power struggles that come up, whether it's within the group or whether it's within the label or within the label communicating with their artists. When it's within the group, it's the manager's job to keep everyone on the same page, which is the band and what's best for the band. Sometimes with a label, you get into political issues where you may lose a president that signed, or an A&R that signed the artist, and now you have a new president or a new person who may not be sure about the group. And the manager has to get that new president or new A&R excited about his band and keep the focus on him and keep him as the focal point. So a manager has to navigate the politics and power and egos of the record label and within his own band. An artist representing himself as a manager is sort of like that thing they say about lawyers, like your Young Awards lawyer. It's the exact same thing. There's no separation. There's no. I usually tell people to try not to hire either family or themselves as their own managers. It's just usually those things don't work out.
Yeah, that's my man, Mike Williams. Let me try to get him right now. I'm about to go to a commercial break. Ebony says we ain't got him on. Let me go to a commercial break. Be back in 2 minutes.
Wouldn't you just like to feel clean again? In Chicago and surrounding areas, Unique Towel Cleaning Service is the best cleaning service. We do basic cleaning and super cleaning, offices and apartment buildings. We will even clean your barber shop, your beauty shop, your spa or restaurant's towels and aprons. Call Unique Towel Cleaning Service at 773-484-5027. Ask us about our very special offer for our new clients. Call us at 773-484-5027 today and feel clean again.
Hello, This is Prentice L. Allison, founder and president of SPSI, Service Perfect Solutions Incorporated, a network of financial service professionals teaching people how to use life insurance and annuities to retain more of their income and pay the least tax on it. Our toll-free number is 877-902-9048. We are proud to have serviced more than 500 clients, national and international, from ages 0 to 99 for the past 30 years. My tip to you today is, if you are a business owner with at least one employee, including yourself, it would behoove you to get business life insurance. Why? Thank you for asking. 7 points I want to leave with you. Your premiums are tax deductible. Your policy bills cash tax deferred. Your cash reserve inside the policy is yours to use tax-free. The policy will replace your income if death occurred prematurely. The company will pay the premiums if you become disabled. The policy will return all premiums to you when you retire. Last but not least...
Tired, stressed out, or just need me or we time? Then Phoenix Rising, Baltimore's exclusive bed and breakfast, is the place for you. Phoenix Rising offers an unforgettable, rejuvenating experience with exquisite guest rooms. Find peace and calm in the Sedona Room or Haitian Room, or relax in front of a marble fireplace in the Serengeti Room. Call 410-462-2692 today to schedule your escape to Phoenix Rising. Visit us online at phoenixrising.com.
347-838-9825. I got my man, Michael Blue Williams, definitely in the building this time, everybody. What's going on, Mike? How you doing, homie?
What's going on, sir? How are you doing today? Thanks for having me.
No. Thank you for being on my show, because like I told my audience earlier, I'm definitely proud to have you on my show. Not proud that you're one of the world's livest entertainment moguls out there, but that you're using your celebrity for greatness. And the essence of giving back is very important. And to show others a way out of situations, you know, passing on and giving back is what I like to see people really do. No matter how successful you get, no matter where you go, no matter what you know, who you know, it's how you try to help those least of thee and try to, you know, bring those up with you. So when I heard about this Guns for Greatness, and then I looked on the internet, I was proud. I was proud, and I'm proud of the work that you're doing, you know. And with me getting all choked up in the smoke-filled room, why don't you go in there and tell everybody about your Guns for Gun Greatness program, Mike's, your boy on Ebony.
Thanks, man. That was, because we haven't spoken as much over the last few years, we don't get a chance to always catch up. So, I'm proud of you and what you're doing in your and you're trying to inform and keep the people and the masses informed. I am often at odds with everyone else in my industry about what the dumbing down of our radio, what used to be a powerful news source, has now just been dumbed down to be about blogs and other stuff like that. So I am happy you're out there doing your thing, sir.
Man, appreciate that, Mike. Appreciate that. You know, if Ebony told me she would have you on there, man, I should have had you on my New Music Thursday, man, because all these artists I got, you know, from around the world, they'd have been just shaking their pants knowing I had you just listening to their music. But we'll talk about that later. But let's tell my audience about your Guns for Greatness.
Guns for Greatness is a program that I started to try and get young people to turn in illegal guns in exchange for the traditional $200 that New York does for turning in a legal gun, but with the added piece of getting a mentor. And that mentoring piece is designed that I take my resources and my access to different types of people and stuff and get them a mentor that's relevant to what they may want to do. I think that mentoring is usually the most effective when you're being mentored by someone that you can relate to, but also by someone that is in a field you want to be in. So what I was trying to do, what I've been attempting to do, is get these young men and women into a program where their mentors are people that look like them and are relevant in their lives, but then also to reward them for doing the work. So if they do the mentoring work and they show up and do take the necessary steps, they'll also get, like, additional incentives and stuff. So they'll get, like, if they're doing work 30 days in and there's a concert coming into town or a sporting event, that I offer them tickets and stuff just to keep them engaged, because I think that that's part of what's also relevant in today's youth, that everybody's looking for instant gratification. So if we can offer them something, I think we can keep them engaged in the process.
No, Mike, that is so true. That is so true. You see, besides you being so New York, and so New York, you know, and so real and grounded, you know, that is the, what you're doing, or how you're doing it, is the blueprint. You see, you have some people coming out here with corporations and just stipulating, you know, where the money going to go to here, the money going to go to there, and it usually gets stuck in the executive level. And most of the kids don't benefit. They might go to a game or two, but listen, but to be close to the music industry with so many kids and so many youth just either want to be in or be a part of or know so much about it, I mean, just that alone is almost dream fulfilling. And it seems so easy to do. I mean, what you're doing, a lot of athletes can do. You know, a lot of entertainers can do. A lot of movie stars can do. What made you decide to come up with this program? What hit you? What turned your light on and be like, bam, man, that's it. This has to be out here. I gotta put this out here for the people.
It was actually a combination of things. I think one of the things was I had a partner kill himself last year with a gun, and so that sort of already was in my mind. So unfortunately, my partner Chris Lighty killed himself last year, so it was sort of just in my mind anyway. But then here in New York, we deal with something called stop and frisk. And it's a problem for young minorities in the city because we get stopped a disproportionate amount. And I saw the police commissioner doing an interview. And in that interview, he basically challenged those of us in the community to come up with better solutions to get guns and to make the streets safer. So I kind of took that challenge almost personally and decided, all right, well, let me think of something. What's another way that we can do this that doesn't require, you know, brothers getting stopped just randomly in the streets? So it sort of started with that. And then one day, you know, God works in mysterious ways. One day I'm reading a newspaper article about a brother named Bill Henry, who started an organization called Hands Across Harlem. And he was planning a peace march in Harlem where he wanted to try and get kids to, you know, just support peace and not violence. So I read the article about him and saw that this is one man that was doing this by himself. And it sort of just reminded me that one person can make a change. And so just I started making phone calls, started reaching out. A lot of people said they felt it was a really good idea. They liked the mentoring part. And so I was able to pull it all together. It took me about 3 months.
Man, that is beautiful. And that program, matter of fact, you need to bring that program here to the shot because, you know, the youth out here, I'm not going to say wilding, but they're misguided.
No, you
need
the word,
you know,
wilder. They off the chain. Like, y'all, but understand, Chicago is definitely the next stop. The goal, once I got started and started thinking about it, was always to do New York first because I'm a New Yorker, as we can probably hear and tell. But the next phase of it is definitely to come to New York, I mean, to Newark, to Chicago, to Detroit. This program is a program that can be done and duplicated nationwide because it's privately funded. Like, I'm going to private businesses and people to get the funds to pay for the guns and to staff up these events so that I'm able to keep it going. I don't have to deal with a lot of waiting for government funding and stuff like that.
You know, we got the facilities here in the shop. We got the, you know, we got the, that, this, that's what the Tillmans do here in the shop. You know, that's what we all about. And that's why what you're doing, you know, it makes me proud to say I know you for, you know, what you're doing right here. You didn't come up with Mike, you know, that you're a real marauder. You know, I mean, Art Thomas didn't know how to pick some live people. You know what I'm saying? Really educate some live people because just the essence of saying no more. No more violence, you know. No more handguns. No, well, you know, I am Republican, you know, so I'm with the Second Amendment. First of all, let me say that, but I'm not with these children getting a hold of guns. And matter of fact, man, last night on my show, somebody got popped outside my studio on a block, just right off the block. little kid I know. You know what I'm saying? Dude cut my grass last week. But, you know, he helped in the life. You know, I be trying to holler at him get out that life, you know. You know, he helped my, you know, helped my camp, you know, helped my campaign, you know, and all stuff like that. And, well, Emmy said your show was sweet. She had you plugged in for today. She had you plugged in for today. You know, what you was doing, I was like, man, how can I really talk Mike into bringing that here? So we get your stuff up and running, man. I try to make sure I have everything in place and position. So it's just a walk in the park for you here in that program.
So we are definitely coming to Chicago. I plan on being in Chicago before the end of the summer, honestly, to do it. I think that one of the other things that's important when we talk about these young brothers out in the streets and the wilding out stuff and what they're doing is it's not even for real results. Like, the sad part is, I know from talking to young brothers in Chicago, talking to young brothers here in New York and stuff, the money and stuff, when you and I were growing up, when a lot of us were growing up, at least Cass was out there wilding out because Cass was about making that money. People were fighting for territories and whatever the drug game had to offer. This is about just like, they're desensitized. It's a lot of just silliness because they just don't feel any hope. So I'm also trying to get people to give them a little hope again and give them, a lot of these young children are getting lost in the system at 15, 16 years old. So if you get arrested or you get sent to a youth facility or whatever, then you get out at 18 and you don't have a degree or you don't know how to do anything, a mentor could be the piece that you've been missing where you could get at least pointed on the right path or get somebody to show that you have value. So the other part about this is that we're going to keep losing in the streets because the only way that the politicians know how to deal with this is to make tougher gun laws and put more of us away. So my idea is just a pebble being thrown at a mountain, but hopefully it can spark some other ideas and other people to take the initiative so that we can start trying to come up with real solutions to police our own community.
Well, that pebble bounced off that mountain, goes into the lake and start a tsunami. But let's do it like this, because mentoring is the key, because all you want to do, see, like you're saying, Mike, what you're really doing is to take a village theory, because it takes a village. You know, these brothers out here, and matter of fact, these sisters out here, because the girls are wild and hard and hard than these boys out here, just need someone to say, hey, come here. Let me show you something. Let me show you a way. Matter of fact, even give a dude a sandwich. You know what I'm saying? These kids out here hungry, like literally hungry. You know, not only for, you know, money and knowledge, but straight for food and comfort and time. And just to see somebody in your position with your credibility and stature going back to the neighborhoods. I mean, you know, just a kid can just say, I want to be Mike Williams and not CeeLo, you know what I'm saying, or not Kanye, or not, you know, Young Jeezy. You know what I'm saying? I want to be Mike Williams. You know, because that's what he's doing, and he's able to do that. You know, sometimes, you know, the take a village theory should be passed along and shared. Again, what Bloomberg doing down there, the stop and frisk, to me, is unconstitutional, really. You know, illegal search and seizure all day long, but you know that you can do that in New York since 9/11. I don't know, Rahm Emanuel might bring that here because these kids are wild out down a Magnificent Mile. You know, pretty soon they're going to say black folks can't go down to the Magnificent Mile. Right now, we are in the 213. We are at the edge where if we don't grab our youth, there really are no future because they have no direction. You know, like they took music out of school, you know, so children finding hard to even learn the mechanics and rhythms or algorithms of music, you know. And they took, you know, and it's hard for them to get direction on what they want to do and what they want to be. But listen, Mike, this has been bugging me for a while since you told me Rakim coming out that double album. Why did you want to be, what made you decide to become a music manager? And how did you get into, how did you become Mike Williams? No, how did you become Lou Williams?
I chased a dream. I went out on the road with Jodeci. I left college and went on the road with Jodeci. I was kind of disenfranchised with what a college degree was going to give me, and felt that I wanted to try and do something a little more entrepreneurial. And I got out on the road and found a lot of people kind of like me, young people out there sort of hustling and making things happen. And I started doing roadie work and bodyguard work for Jodeci. And then I went from Jodeci to Mary J. Blige and SWV. And I just kept growing and learning and kept trying to improve my position and improve my income until I eventually became a manager. And as a manager, I worked at Queen Latifah's company, Flavor Unit, and found Outkast and found Monica and started managing them. And that started my journey as a manager. And so now, like almost 18 years later, just straight up management, my company, Family Tree Entertainment, is one of the top management companies in the game. And we manage Life Jennings and CeeLo Green and Nick Cannon, Eric Benet, Case. And so it's just a constant growth. You don't ever stop trying to grow and learn. And management in the music industry has changed in recent years. So we're doing a lot more. It's a lot more work than it was for a long time. And it's more about managing brands and looking at your talent as brands and trying to create as many financial opportunities as you can for them. But it's fun. That's what I enjoy doing. It. I enjoy taking an unknown artist and making them a superstar.
Yeah, that was always in your eyes. That was always in you. And I always say Rakim's double album because I was waiting for you to prove everybody a liar. And that's years since you got it on the scoop that Rakim was coming out with a double album. Ladies and gentlemen, it was like back in 1987, 88. Rakim was just hitting hard with Paid in Full just drop. And Mike come in and said, man, I was just hollering at Rakim. Wait till this double album drop. I've been waiting since 88 for the double album. Now you managing, man, with your little hookup, man. Make that, man, make that come true. The fans want a double album, Mike. But anyway, you said your program has been funded privately. So do you find that a lot of private people are coming on board, not for a tax write-off, but just because they really believe in what you're doing here?
Yeah, I'm finding that people are really interested. I really believe that people that are able to help want to help. They just have mm-hmm. to be pointed in the direction of how to help. And so a lot of times people don't know how to fit helping into their daily schedule or they don't know, like, how to sign up or do whatever. So I've been speaking to people and giving them the option to, you know, volunteer to be a mentor or to donate or have their company donate or just however they can think to help us move this process along. And what I'm finding is everyone's really open to it, whether it's artists or just everybody, doctors I talk to, people that are reading about it in newspapers and seeing me on TV. Everyone's receptive to trying to find a way to help because everyone agrees that there's a problem.
Mike, this is Ebony checking in. Thank you for being on the show. I want to, for some of our listeners who's not familiar with the Guns to Greatness program, could you, like, tell them some of the, you know, tickets, things that you've given for the Guns, what's been turned in? I saw that Saturday there was a big turn-in. Kind of give us a little catch-up on, you know, exactly what's been happening with the program.
So the way it works is you come in, you turn in the gun, you get a card. On that card is a money card for $200 cash that you can go and cash in. You also get a number to call the Guns for Greatness hotline. And when you call in, we'll set up a meeting for you to come and sit down and speak with us. And when you speak, we're going to find out what it is you're trying to do so we can make sure we match you up with the right mentor. And following that, you'll start doing the work. And we partnered up with Susan Taylor and her National Cares Program. We partnered up with a young man named Stephen Powell who has Mentoring USA. And these guys are sort of showing us how to do the mentoring part the right way because I didn't want to have to try and reinvent the wheel. I wanted to try and tap into already existing programs.
Okay. So what type of population have you been getting? Do you see that you know, these guns are really coming up off the street from, you know, what are the demographics of who's turning in the guns?
We got 115 guns off the street this weekend. Of them, 90 of them were handguns, or 89 of them were handguns, 33 were pistols. of the handguns that came in, most of them were like 10 of them were guns with that had their serial number and everything scraped off, which on the streets we all know that means those are guns that are being used for illicit activities, so to speak. What we found was we saw you always have some people that are just older and are bringing in guns just because, you know, they're like, hey, I don't need this thing anyway. But what we also were finding was that I had a mother bring in her son. I had a father find the gun in his son's room and bring it in. We had a bunch of women bringing them in, but we could tell they were bringing them in because their boyfriends were too scared to bring them in. But we did this at the Christian Cultural Center in Brooklyn, which is in East New York, which is the murder capital for New York consistently. So we wanted to go and do it right in the heart of where things happen and try and encourage. And we also understand that I'm not always going to get the hardened criminal. That person that's determined to be a lifelong criminal, that's not the one I'm even trying to get. What I'm trying to get is that kid that might be taking a gun because he's scared and he's going to get caught and he's going to end up with a felony. Or I'm trying to get that kid that just is like he thinks this is an option because he doesn't have any more. So, you know, the idea is to get them to at least look at things from a different angle.
Yeah, so when you have your guns turned in, what age is the youngest age you might have seen? You know, I know if I ain't looking at the gangsters, the 30s and 25s, but do any like 15s, 14s, 17-year-old turning any weapons in?
Yeah, I got 16 and 17-year-olds that were doing it, that were turning the gun in. And I had parents of 16 and 17-year-olds that were doing it also. So the idea is 16 to 37-year-olds. In New York City, 90% of the violent crimes committed are committed by 16 to 37-year-old minorities. So our demographic is to get that kid. I'm trying to get that hip-hop audience. I'm trying to get when NYPD and the DA's office usually do this, they usually do it and they end up getting a bunch of people in their 30s, 40s, or 50s. What I'm trying to do is I want to get that young kid to turn in his gun. So, yeah, we had a lot of 17, 18-year-old looking kids that were coming through. They might have been 19, 20. They all look the same age to my old self.
Okay, look, Mike, we need to take a quick break because, you know, we got to pay some bills. And we're going to come right back to you. Thank you for listening to Jimmy Lee Underground Radio Network. That's 347-838-9825. Be back.
Partners in Community Building focuses on credit building, financial literacy, and home ownership for residents throughout Chicago and Illinois. All of our services are free. Call 312-328-0873 to get additional information on our homeownership counseling, rental assistance, Cook County foreclosure mediation, and small accessible repairs for seniors programs. PCIB is a HUD-certified nonprofit counseling agency committed to addressing the housing needs of all people. Call 312-328-0873 to schedule an appointment or visit us at www.pcibchicago.org.
For true inspiration, check out singer, songwriter, and radio personality Sylvia Fedrick. Sylvia, your sister under God's construction, brings to you her best in Christian contemporary gospel tunes, and they are available for download at www.sangsyl.com. That's SANGSYL.com. Or you can visit her profile at Chicago Black Business Network. For bookings, call Sassy Michelle at 512-914-4221.
Want to learn the secrets of the wealthy? Do you think that the wealthy sell their gold and silver, or do they buy gold and silver? Learn to create wealth, collect wealth, and preserve wealth for you and future generations. Find out how you can acquire free silver every month. Visit goldandsilverplan.com. That's goldandsilverplan.com. What you don't know can keep you struggling financially. What you know can change your life. Be in the know. Visit goldandsilverplan.com today.
When were you last on an amazing vacation? I'm Tracy Lewis, leisure travel specialist with Pogo World Travel, and I'm here to tell you that you don't have to go it alone when planning the vacation of a lifetime. So the next time you're looking for expert advice on that perfect vacation, you've got Pogo World Travel every step of the way. Visit our website at gowithpogo.com today and find out why they say, go with Pogo World Travel and discover your dream of vacation come true.
I think as a manager, when I look at artists, I think I look for, L.A. Reid has taught me something, the president of Island Def Jam, chairman of Island Def Jam, LaFace for so many years, to look for the star. Try and find that star. Like, you can always, you can make an artist look good, you can clean them up, but a star's a star. A star's going to look good whether they're grimy looking and you got to clean them up, or they're going to look good the day they walk in the artist, but you get that star quality. And I think in my career I've been blessed to be able to spot stars, whether I end up managing them or not, or whether I just have worked with them and held them close. And that helps, because a star is always easier to market, sell, brand. I've been blessed. I've managed Monica on her first album. I've managed Outkast for their career. I had Donnell Jones and Macy Gray. And I've had a lot of these artists that some had great albums or great projects, but may not have had the star quality to last it out over the long haul. And some had the ability, but just didn't have the desire. And I think that's what you don't find out until you get into the trenches with the artist. So sometimes when you pick them, you may see the star quality, but you may find out later they don't have that desire to do it. They just sort of want to they think they want to be stars. I think that's the part you got to try. I think when you meet with an artist, as a manager, I like to look in their eyes and see if they get it, if they understand what I'm talking about, like the work, and try and see if they're really being honest with themselves about really wanting it. And if I don't think they're really, if I think it's going to be like a short-lived, I think it's going to be a headache, I personally would rather not manage an artist that's going to be a headache than manage somebody who's going to sell 500,000, but it's going to be great to work with. Passion, talent, some luck. I think to be successful, to get that successful formula, you got to have something that, like I said, that star quality. Sometimes it's just that little piece that drives. I think desire outweighs intelligence, can't hurt. You know, having an intelligent artist is always better. Those are the things. I think it really comes from a lot of stars on the inside, and then people feed off of what the artist sometimes give. Like, you know, if an artist is a pain in the neck, I tell artists all the time, that let me be the bad guy at the label. You know, you be the person that the label is happy to see when you come through. Everybody wants to give you a hug. Because people have to want to like you to go that extra step for you. So if you're a pain in the behind and you're difficult, then when that girl's finished working at 6 o'clock and she still needs to, she has to decide whether she wants to go home and go about her Friday night, or stay another hour and a half and make your reservation so everything you have is right. If you're not somebody that she likes or deals with, she's going to shut off her computer and go home. But if you're an artist that she's like, oh, I want to make sure they're right because I feel endeared to the project, and he's always nice to me, and he sent me flowers for my birthday, she'll stay till 11 o'clock at night to work. That's what makes stars in the music industry in the world and every place, and people don't know that. That's that little factor that makes the difference. That's why an artist makes a show, or why you see someone in the press clippings more than you see others. Because some artists get up and they make every interview. Some artists are never on time. And I think those little small things are the deciding factors in a lot of careers. I think having some business sense is vital for an artist. I think you need to understand the business at least have a general like shift of it. I'm not saying know the difference between points, royalties, and how much you're getting on each record and clog your brain up with it if you're not really interested. But have a general sense of how business works. Understand that if someone does something above and beyond for you, that you may want to say thank you or send them back a gift. That if somebody does something that they didn't have to do and that helps your career, that you may want to at least acknowledge it or remember their name. I think you should have a sense of business and how it works in general, just across the world, and what is good, you know, etiquette, you know, that how you should treat people, how you should act. Things like that, and I think that goes one way. Anyway, if you have good manners, I find that artists that have good manners, have good home training, make much more pleasant artists to work with. Mm-hmm. Artists that don't have a lot of home training and start to believe that the world is about them, or they have people that blow smoke up their behinds all the time, then they're disconnected from reality. And I think that's when it becomes dangerous.
It was Panda X's, my man, Mike Williams, and what you're looking for in a star artist like that. Listen, Mike, I don't want to hold you. I really don't want to hold you up that long. I know you're busy, man, getting the project, stuff like that going on. But listen, on your downtime, man, I got this day called New Music Thursday. And we know, if I just one day just sit in, or, you know, sit in on my little session and hear all these unsigned artists just try to make it big. Or you just one day just surf through my little backlog. I got a lot of people who just wish they just get a chance to have somebody like you just even listen to their music. You know, if you ain't doing that one Thursday. But anyway, where can they find information, any donors, any private companies, any business people that might want to give to your program? What is any websites or any web pages or anything else
to
find
you
out, Mike?
They can follow us on Twitter at Guns for Greatness. They can hit our Facebook, Guns for Greatness, or they can go to the website, which is www.gunsforgreatness.org. And, you know, that site, is since it's still new, we're still always trying to improve it and make it as easy for everyone as possible. But any one of those, you can go on there, you can ask a question, you can reach out, and either somebody on the team will get back to you.
Okay, that's good. But listen, again, thank you, man. Hold on. Again, Mike, when you get that stuff plugged in, I would love to bring that program to the Shy, because we definitely need it here. And we the murder capital now, you know, murder capital of America. I think it'll be moving. But I was going to try to target the younger audience, because in Chi-Town, people shooting that from 14 to 19. Here's the rate of people popping around here. The old heads in jail, there ain't nobody popping like that. So I think what you're doing is definitely beautiful. So hit up in the Shy, just let me know, man. You know.
Thank you. Nah, like I said, I'm coming to the Shy. I'm going to hold you to that, and I'll let you know when we're ready to move that way.
Man, I work hard on it, man. If you need to look up these Tillman and see how we do it, Mike, we do it up, man. Again, you are blessed, man. Your God has blessed you. May the Most High continue to bless. Much success to you. Again, I feel honored to talk to you for what you're doing, and I think it's a very beautiful program. This is coming from a Second Amendment gun rights advocate, total Republican. This is coming from a black man, and what you're doing is excellent, and it should be modeled, and you should be imitated, my man. You should be imitated.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate the time and talking.
All right. Ebony got your number. We can, like I said, we're going to plug up and see how we're going to do this in a couple of months and set it up, Mike. Real talk. So I'm going to go out with some CELO therapy. We paying it like that, Ebony.
All right, goodbye, bro. Thanks a lot.
Thank you,
young bloods hanging out at the store 24/7, drunk is looking for a hit of the blow. It's powerful. Oh, you know what else they trying to do? Make a curfew, especially for me and you. The traces of the new world order. Time is getting shorter. If we don't get prepared, people, it's gonna be a soda. My mind won't allow me to not be curious. My folks don't understand, so they don't take it serious. But every now and then, I wonder if the gate was put up to keep mine out of keep our ass in.
Who's there kicking in my window?
Listen up, little nigga, I'm talking to you about what your little ass need to be going through. I fall a victim too, and I know I shouldn't smoke so much, but I do. With the proof every day, on the average, my 4 or 5. I'm lucky to be alive and survive. I won't be alive to call after I lost my best friend, Bean. I recognize as a king. Who am I to tell you to stop smoking? Now you open to disease and cold, and ain't 16 years old. This shit has got to stop. Let's take a walk through detox. I won't out of this hole. I'm in the cell under attack. Look up, folks. They in the hood. Got an eye on every move I make. Open your face to info. You would know, cause it's kept low. How the new world plan reached the planet without the black
so
man.
So what's your aim? Try to separate me from the blood of disrespect, like coming in my home and not wiping your feet on the rug. The citron absolute has got me bucking no hand with no phone. Look out for the man with the mask and the white pony on my back appeal. Staying off my toes, always on my heels, the same plane. Soldiers coming in the dark, my plane to report the new system by rain. Tag my skin with your computer chip. Run your hand over the scanner to buy your dish now. No more fishing for your fish.
No more fishing for my fish.
Of the old days, pathway gone, mind blown, perception, perception. My name on your selection, but I call the tongue. Who's there peeking in my window? Nobody's around. Who's there peeking in my window? Nobody's around. Who's there peeking in my window? Nobody's now. Who's there peeking in my window?
You know something, I was rocking to Who Was That Peeping in My Window with Goody Mob for a second. Sitting back thinking on when Mike did jump from Jodeci. Everybody like, Mike was from Jodeci, yeah. He just told me that little story about Rakim and his double album. Then he said, man, I'm out of here, nigga. What? I'm about to go to Jodeci. Yeah, whatever, Mike. And he came back with Jodeci on the y'all like, nigga, fuck y'all. I told y'all. But I'm very proud of him. You know, like I was telling Ebony off the mic, it's not what you know or who you know, is what you're doing for those you know. You got to give back, everybody. We got to give back. One more cut to my man. Here's another group. Here's another person my man Mike Williams produced. I'm going to get back into the topic because we're coming up on the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. We might have a Wednesday show dedicated to that on Thursday. But let me go in there and give this Philo, Family Tree Entertainment Management, Big Blue.
Yeah. Lord, it's so hard living this life, a constant struggle each and every day. Some wonder why I'd rather die than to continue living this way. Many are blind and cannot find the truth of no one seems to really know. But I won't accept that this is how it's gonna be. Therefore, you got to let me and my people go. cause I wanna be free, completely free. Lord, won't you please come and save me? I wanna be free, totally free. I'm not gonna let this world worry me, cause we wanna be free, totally free.
Let me go, listen, I'm in a black moment mode for a second. I was like my mama, because tomorrow is dedication to Martin Luther King, and it's, I want to be free. No, but the fourth, we can't do the fourth. It's New Music Thursday, and I don't want to, you know, turn people off, so I'm going to do a pre-up. Because I figure everybody's going to have Thursday locked down, so I'm going to stand alone, so I think we do our stuff Wednesday, you know. But I think we got Martin Luther King a roll tape on our upload. Going to keep it creative. We haven't. We got to keep it what?
Gotta keep it what?
I ain't gonna say it. Gotta keep it ghetto. Gotta keep it gangster.
First of all, a work ethic. I'm a strong believer in the work ethic. I like to tell them what a teacher told me, that there are no shortcuts to glory. And when I use glory, I don't mean the frills and the ruffles. There's no shortcut to success, whatever that success may be. I'd like to reiterate what I was taught in early on. And I got that not just from my mother, but my grandmother, who used to say, remember your place now. And that disturbed me. And I knew what she was saying and why she was saying it. She was saying it to protect me also. And that's why I said, particularly the young black children, your place is anywhere you want it to be. It's left up to you. You make that decision. To young politicians, I want to make a plea for elective office. Seek power. There's nothing wrong with power if it's used wisely and used rightly. Power is essential. Power is what gets things going, and it can be used for good as well as for evil. Some people think of power, the powerful person as being evil. I think the powerful person as being good.
Yeah, that's Ed Brooks. And stuff. Let me keep it Mike Blue Williams for one more time. Ebony wanted to play another one. Which one was that? This is him working with Outkast, Mike Williams. Even though you heard this already, Mike, my people haven't. That's all we got. You know, my bad. I'm going to do a Mike Williams show just, you know, just for you because I'm proud of you, homie. So 347-838-9825 is the number. And so let me go on ahead and bring Mike Blue Williams working with Outkast. July 3rd, 2010.
We grew in the group grew up. I think the first person we have to thank would be L.A. Reid. L.A. never put restraints on the guys. He always let them do what they knew how to do. I tell people that it was a blessing that we had a unique relationship because Big Boy and Dre are originally from Atlanta, from the South. They had a Southern perspective and a Southern appreciation of the music, and they had the unique way that they wanted it to sound and how it was. Me coming from New York, I had a different perspective. I understood New York and the music industry and the business side and how the business industry looked at everything. And I think the combination of my New York way and my hustle in New York style and their Southern flavor and what they had created the type of perfect storm for us to win fights when it was like if I went into CLA and creatively, it seemed a little outside the box. The guys, L.A., had to respect them, so he let them live. If I came in and it was business that needed to be handled, he had to respect my business acumen. So we gained the success that we earned by being able to win a lot of fights and being able to take those risks. And when we won, it gave us a little more room the next time. And I think what really helped us when we got to Stankonia and Level on Speaker Box is that by then,
Outkast fans had given us such a wide berth to take chances and express and do things differently and live, that we just got into a groove where it was like, we just do what we do. We don't worry about what anybody else is doing. The guys aren't copying radio or hearing whatever the people are doing musically. They just do what they do. I'm not sitting around, like, trying to market and do the same thing with each project. I'm constantly looking at where the world is at that particular time right before we come out, and how can we get in and make an impact? How do we market this record and do it a little differently? And I think that combination, and Big Dre and myself, we stay in our lanes. It's like what we like to say within our camp. I don't make music. You know, I let them make music. They let me do what I do on the marketing and deal making, and it's proven like a very successful formula for us. I think if there was a moment that was more like a turning point, then I don't think we ever sat around and said, yeah, we're going to do something totally new. I think it's just always worked out that I got an idea. I don't think I've seen anybody do it before, but I got an idea. Later, when you look back, everybody's like, yo, this is new and groundbreaking. But I think the turning point for our career was we had an opportunity to go on tour with Lauryn Hill. And I always have to, you know, thank Lauryn and shout him out for taking us out on that tour and giving us the opportunity. But it was, the truth of the matter is Lauryn and them didn't want to pay us what we felt we were worth on that tour. And I saw the tour as a huge opportunity for us to go from being the Southern rap band to getting in front of Lauryn's fans. And this was the Miseducation of Lauryn, and they just come off of selling 12 million The Score albums, and she was on her roll for this, and she was going on tour. And I felt like if we could get in front of the Lauryn fans, I knew we could make those fans our fans. So we went out on that tour for pennies, like, you know, Lauryn and them got us. We got handled with the money, but it was worth it to me. And I tell people all the time, Big Boy and Dre probably fired me 10 times on that tour because we fought about the money. We fought about how much we were getting paid and whether we were shortchanging ourselves. But every night I was just seeing the fans and their eyes were getting, and they were looking, and they were sort of amazed by Dre and what he was wearing, and amazed by Big Boy's personality and the guy's showmanship together. And every night we went out there, we ripped that stage up, and we made it harder on Lauryn every night to come on that stage after us. And from that tour, it changed the perception of us, I believe, because the media and a lot of the media that decides whether you're going to be hot, sexy, and fly was at those shows because they wanted to see Lauryn. And those that saw us were like, hey, this little group is doing their thing. And I think that's what opened us up to a lot of mainstream success and a lot of opportunities that weren't there before. It also financially, when we finished that tour, our numbers almost doubled and tripled on what people were willing to pay for us to come through. And so the Lauryn Hill tour gave us the opportunity and to step up from just being a normal group and taking it up a level. I think after we did the Lauryn Hill tour, mainstream media, the cool media, everybody had their eyes on us. They were paying attention to what we were doing. When we dropped the next album, and we started out, we had Miss Jackson and those type of hits. Once we got a really big radio hit, now mainstream and everyone's paying attention, we're crossing over. So I had an opportunity for us to go on our own type of tour. So we went out on a tour, and actually, me and the guys, I remember making sure we wanted to give somebody the opportunity that we had. So I remember us taking Ludacris out on that run with us, you know, and we took Ludacris, and he opened up for us. So Ludacris, when I look at Chris now, and I look at where his sales are and where he is compared to some of his peers that came out with him, the reason that Ludacris sells 2 to 4 million records now is because he was in front of the same type of fans that we were in front of with Lauryn. People were like, Outkast, Outkast. And then they saw Chris come out and kill the show every night. Mm-hmm. I think that the crossover and the things that fed into it was that while we had songs like Miss Jackson and we had the success that we were having, I was never afraid to book the guys to go do the Winter X Games. I was never afraid to go and do skater events. And we would do, the guys were like, yo, hey, the money's right, we'll go do it. Let's go ahead and do credible and the right stuff. So we would go and do those shows and rock them. And we'd go on tours in the summer, and we'd be on tour and going right before Moby on a tour or something like that, and we'd take Moby fans. So whenever we would go on tour, we always take people's fans. And that's what always Outkast and touring has always been about for us. It's always been about getting out there and making new fans and making them ours. So if you put us on before Lauryn Hill, we're going to make Lauryn Hill's fans ours. If you put us on before Moby, we're going to make Moby's fans ours. If you put us on tour with George Clinton, we're going to get the Parliament and all those fans. And that's how we've always done it. And so that the touring aspect of who Outkast is was very vital. Along with like doing TV and always being able to translate the energy from our videos and what you saw on stage. A lot of groups, you see one thing, like, in a video, it's a different thing when you see them live, or this is a whole different, you're not getting the same. With OutKast, the energy you see in the video is the same energy you see with them on stage, is the same energy that you see when they do David Letterman. So it's no letdown. You're excited to see them perform with Jackson on the Tonight Show. You're excited to see them when you go see them in a concert. And that carried over with Bombs Over Baghdad into Miss Jackson and then into, like, a Hey Ya and the way you move. So I really, really like those and always maintaining that. And, again, L.A. Reid and the label, and we've had fights and stuff like that. But when the guys feel like, yo, we wore this outfit and we need to hone new outfits for this, keep energy and keep it fresh, them letting us go ahead and giving us the money and wardrobe to go keep that fresh and to do those things and keep the fans excited and guessing, or giving the guys the wardrobe money so that they can constantly come up with new looks on magazine covers and things like that. And I think that as management, it's those fights that you do, and the guys getting having the creative energy just to keep coming up with stuff, so it makes it easier for you to go fight. And each time you win, you know, you get a bigger, like, bat to go fight the label with. And there's times where things just sometimes work out. Like, I remember fighting with L.A. Reid about Dre performing at the halftime of Super Bowl with the Justin and all that stuff. And we were like, nah, we don't want to do it. We don't want to do it. In hindsight, it's great that we didn't do it because that was a crazy Super Bowl and everything. But I think there's also been a lot of fate and a lot of, like, things falling in the right place at the right time. I always believed that OutKast could be as successful as we've been. I've actually felt like we could be even bigger than we are. You know, I definitely always, when I first started managing OutKast and I got to know the guys, I sort of had a chip on my shoulder because I felt like people, like, were, like, talking about the Loonies when we first came out. And then with 95 style, like, people were never really giving the guys their props. And then when we came up to New York and it was the Source Awards and all this other stuff, I always felt like we were getting jerked. I think for the first two albums, we ran around with a chip on our shoulder, like trying to make people pay attention. And so my goal eventually went from when we started getting the critical acclaim and getting five mics and stuff and things like that, I started going from wanting to be the biggest, like, rap group in the world to wanting to make the guys the biggest just group band in the world. So to me, as much success as we've had, I'm still not done with what I think we can really be. Like, I want to be what the Eagles and the Rolling Stones and those groups are for a generation of people. I want to be able to look up in 20 years, and if the guys want to go on the road, that we can fill up stadiums like the Eagles and those people can and make $50, $60 million a summer and just touring out and just touring on the summer. Because I really think that we've created a brand that's going to last, you know, and we're going to have the option to do what we want to do. I think creatively, I study their managers. I study some of the moves. I'm like, Irving Azoff, the manager of the Eagles, and Doc, this manager, Rob Jovi, all these type of managers. I find that one thing is that most of the time they've had the same manager, so it's been a formula that works well, you know, so there's some consistency. I find that every group goes through, like, some time where they need some space apart to appreciate, like, and really step back and really soak in everything that they have accomplished and done. I think the similarities is that we've had that type of run that great bands have at one point. When you look at a great band's career sometimes, like a U2 or this, you can look at a string of albums in a row, or you can look at what that groundbreaking landmark album that defined that group is, and then they turn around and follow it up, or two albums later they follow up. And that's the difference, I think, between average artists and great artists. I think great artists have more than one defining album. I think when you're a great group or you're a great band or a great artist, your fans can sit around and argue about which album is better. I think when you are a good artist and you're just an artist that had, like, some good records, then everyone knows what your best album is. They know, oh, that was this best album. I think with OutKast, we have people that argue that Aquemini was our best album. You know, we have some that feel like Stankonia. We have some that feel Love Blown Speaker Box. That means that we've laid out a good quality work, and I think that better work is always going to, like, last. And I still manage the group with a chip on my shoulder. I don't think that we get everything we should get out of it, like all the press and everything that we should get sometimes. I don't feel like we get mentioned high enough on greatest albums sometimes. I don't feel we get mentioned in most relevant artists sometimes. I feel like the Fugees sold 12 million records on the score, and I feel like that was a single album. We sold 13 million on our album, but it was a double album. So I feel like, could we have sold 12, like, and could we really have made it 24? So it's just my personal competitive edge is always trying to see what we can do better and how we can do it differently and push the envelope.
Yeah, that's my man Mike Lou Williams. We're going to be right back, everybody, in 4 minutes. I hope y'all enjoying my little clip, my homie. You know, proud of what he's doing, this gun back program. 347-838-9825. Be back in 4 minutes.
My part of town, my part of town, it's similar to Vietnam. My part of town, my part of town, it's similar to Vietnam. My part of town, my part of town, it's similar to Vietnam.
You don't know her.
Similar to Vietnam.
You don't know her. You don't live where
I'm from. The place of domestic violence, for the people dying from the self-hatred virus, where the kids go to school and they think learning is cruel. Must forget about the kids in the world with no shoes, a food to eat for a freaking week. We walk around $100 sneakers on our feet and brag and boast in the ghettos as we toast the Patron, claiming streets we don't even own. On crone in our home, I'm devoid of a father figure. That's why the brothers be out here like I'm a
gangster nigga.
Learn your history lesson. Learn how they slaughtered and murdered our ancestors. How? Now that's gangster how they did our ancestors. Now you ain't a gangster cause you say it on the record, huh? The real gangster, you fakers, all the automakers and the bankers that still owe us 40 acres.
My part of town, my part of town, it's similar to Vietnam.
You don't know.
Don't tempt me, getting paid. But really, pockets is empty, ain't that strange? Across 8 Mile, it's calm. Detroit is more similar to Vietnam. And the unified niggas is a hard ass job. We want to live in these slums and let our sounds go. Boom, boom. Dumb when we young. Be damned if it's one of my sons not come where I'm from.
Where you from?
And take a walk down Murder Lane on the Ave where the girls are insane. With the sag, I hate on the flag. How long will this foolishness last? Can you add, do the math, huh? Fast food plus some cartoons, plus the lack of love equal kids so rude. Parents too soon, killing to get more.
Get money,
we're spiritually poor, this is war.
My part of town, my part of town, it's similar to Vietnam.
You don't know.
That's a recession is ended, oh yeah? Around here ain't nobody hiring. How about to come to your crib and steal your copper wiring? Or even worse off, get the firing. Have you down chase the pavement cause your car they're admiring. I bet you wouldn't think it's over then. Tough times turn warm hearts to colder men. And it ain't just the youth, it's the older men. It's floating after so long from holding in. Pain stains the heart till you can't smile. And Vietnam ain't got nothing, no finger to 8 Mile. It's enough to make your bones quiver. I'm surprised they ain't put battleships in the Detroit River. This ain't living, this is hell. People feel like they living in a prison, no different than a cell. Cause they scared to walk the streets they dwell, wondering if they gonna be another innocent kill. Cause cats lost consciousness, they killing that will. Whatever happened to the love revealed? Let's bring it back, huh?
My part of town, my part of town, it's similar to Vietnam.
You don't know.
My bad, everybody. I faded everything out for a second. Let me go back with Mike Williams on the music industry today, everybody. I apologize for the delay.
I think that the major change in the music industry has come from just the way the labels are approaching the game today. I think in the 90s, were, especially the mid to late 90s, were a great year for the music industry. We were selling a lot of records, big sales, music was driving everything, we were all making a lot of money, it was great. And then, you know, the millennium changed, and people started downloading and stuff like that, and I think the industry was slow to adapt, and we ended up behind the curve. And I think that that's what everyone's been trying to recover from since then. I also think that in the 90s, like seeing like rappers with big cars and doing everything was new and it was exciting. We had shows like Cribs and all those type of shows. And I think there may have been too much TV and too much MTV and too much access that now in 2006, it seems easy to kids. Kids see you on TV and they think, like, I can be an instant success, or I can be, if I win American Idol, I could be a star quickly. And they don't see the hard work. Even if you watch American Idol, they don't show what these kids and they have to do every day of the week up until that Wednesday and Thursday. They don't see the press. They don't see the hard work. They don't see the recording. People don't see that. TV makes it, cuts it so they keep your attention. And people don't see the hard work that it takes to make things happen. And I think that what it's done is it's made today's society, especially the younger society, think that things come easily. And I find that when I meet interns or I meet young people out there that they want to do it, they want to jump in and be me where I am now, as opposed to me where I was at their age, where I had to get in. And I think that's the major change that I see in the industry, is that people don't really understand that it's still a lot of work that goes into making an artist a success, or to having a successful management company or running a successful label, that it takes like elbow grease. You got to get in there and grind, and people don't appreciate the grind anymore. I think there's a difference in generations. I come from a generation of Puffy and, you know, all of us that came up in the early 90s where that's what we did. Like, hustle was what we did. If you weren't hustling on the streets, you got in the music industry, but you kept the same hustle mentality, and you become successful. You're Mark Pitts, who is a VP A&R who came up, who was Biggie's manager, or you're Puff, or you're Damon and them at FUBU, or you're me, or you're all these people, you're Chris Lighty. Like, we come from a generation where you do it, and you hustle, and you grind, and you make it happen yourself. You don't rely on anybody to do it for you. So I think we just inbred. All of us came out of the streets in New York, and that's how it was growing up in the streets. You just got in there. Mm-hmm. These kids, you know, they hear, like, Tony Yayo gets caught, and he goes to jail, and Yayo gets out of jail, and then he has a $1 million record deal, and that's what it is. I'm going to be fly like that. I ain't got to grind. And so they think it's easy. They don't know what Yale's whole story is. They don't know what Yale had to go through and stuff like that. So I think it's a difference in the generations. I think it's a real difference. I find that peers and friends I have in different industries, they find the exact same thing. So I really think it's just how kids were raised after, like, my generation that came up. I think that it's not so much, I think it's less of an argument between the going the major route or the indie route. The indie route is more, the majors have a model. They're going to do it a certain way. It's pretty much they throw up against the wall, see what sticks. They got a cookie cutter formula on how they're going to break an artist. We're throwing it up, see if it works. Independent labels are more personal. They can flow. Like, if you're on an independent label and your artist is hot in Milwaukee, then you get that artist to Milwaukee and you grind them out in Milwaukee for 6 weeks. And then you get a buzz in St. Louis, you shoot to St. Louis. Independent labels are more fluid. Majors are definitely a big machine that you got to turn. Now, when the machine gets hot and gets a hit, the major's going to move a lot more units than an independent will, because they're going to be able to jump on and move the whole machine behind that. But you'll make more money on an independent label. But, you know, you're not going to get as much marketing. It's harder to create a brand independently. I tell people that for marketing dollars and what labels will spend on building a brand, that, you know, major may be a better choice. It really depends on your threshold of paying with your money. You know, if you're doing independent and you got money that you can put into it, you know, run that route. Take a shot. Swing at it. If you create enough of a buzz, a major may come by you. You know, if you're not sure, you don't have the money to do it yourself, and you're like, I just need a deal. I got music. I want to get out there. I know I'm good. Then you may go the label route. Go the major route and let them do it and market you and get it out there and take advantage of that opportunity.
I get a little lonely. Sometimes I
I get a little blue. A very strange Janet boy. They say he wandered very far, very far over land and sea. A little shy. Very wise. What he and then one day, a magic day he had my way. And while we spoke of many things, he said to me, the greatest thing you ever learn is just to love and be loved in me. Sometimes I get a little lonely, and sometimes I get a little blue. The greatest thing is just to love, be loved in return.
Happened specifically, the end result is that he's gone and we've lost a leader.
And there have also been reports, some of them conflicting, about the events in his life that may have led to this. They range from marital problems to financial problems to the pressure of the industry. What other factors could have weighed into that? And the question is was depression part of that?
I think that the pressure that comes with being a manager, a leader, an icon, as Chris was, can weigh on people, and it can weigh it's a heavy burden to carry, and, you know, that weight can affect you, and it can start to take its toll on you, and I think that sometimes when you can around that much weight, we as men, as black men, as hip-hop entrepreneurs and stuff, we don't always let it on that we're carrying that much weight. And so it affects everyone differently, and especially if you internalize it, it can really eat away at you from the inside out.
Not long before Chris, there was another very high-profile young black music executive, Shakir Stewart, who was also found dead as a result of an apparent suicide, with lots of speculation that he may have dealt with depression. There have also been others in the community. Depression is not unique to the black community, but the question is there a cultural difference in the way that it's viewed and dealt with in the black community, and what do you do about that?
I think the problem that we face as young black men as we come up, that you have a lot of brothers that didn't have father figures, so they already weren't used to talking to other men about their problems. And so it's internalized it, keep up the image. You have to keep this strong image in this game where weakness is can be a dangerous thing to show. And unfortunately, in the black community and in the hip-hop commercials, such a misogynistic game that, you know, depression, some type of mental illness, anything that can be viewed as a weakness is hidden. And to me, that's where the root of the problem is, that whether it was Shakir or whether it's Chris or so many other young brothers out here that just feel like they have to carry the weight of the world on their shoulders, to feel like they don't want to expose themselves to being normal and having problems and being under stress. Like the stigmatism that there's something wrong with going to see a therapist, that there's something wrong with going to see a doctor. You know, it's those type of things that are an additional burden on a young black man when he's trying to rise and build his career and build a company and build his life and start a family, that if we take nothing away from these type of tragedies, I would hope that we could open up a channel or a way for men to talk to each other and feel safe and understand that it's not going to come back and bite you. Because I understand the side of, you don't want to expose yourself as having issues and have to go back in and negotiate with somebody later and have that used against you. But, you know, talk to somebody outside of your cycle. Find a support group. Talk to someone that can help you talk it out. I've been to therapy. I went and had to talk through some of the stresses that I have dealt with in my job. And I realized that you do get a certain relief from just verbalizing stuff. And if more of my peers, more of my brothers, compatriots can realize that it's not a weakness to do it, I think then that's the first step towards a better healing in our community.
And if anyone can relate to the pressures that go along with this job, you can, because you've managed some of the biggest names in the music business. Take me inside the life of a manager and when you actually manage these superstars, not one, but five, six, seven, eight of them at one time, the kinds of things that factor into that can cause pressure.
When you're a manager, you absorb and take on all of the problems of your clients. In a nutshell, your job is to shield your clients from everything that distracts them from making money and making music. So you take on their issues with their families. You take on issues that they may run into in the streets. You take on issues that they have with finances. You deal with the label. You deal with the rest of the outside world. You deal with girlfriends. You deal with whatever they're going through. And you have to navigate and help them navigate through this in this minefield that we call success. But at the same time, at some point in your day, you have to get to your life. And a lot of times when you're a manager, your life is the last thing you get to.
And when you have a superstar artist, especially an artist that, you know, one might call needy and needs a lot of attention, you go from not getting to your life until the end of the day to not getting to your life for a year. It's very easy for you to get wrapped up in a cycle of managing an artist and not get yourself to the doctor, not get yourself to the dentist, not get yourself the proper eating and sleeping and exercising. Because if you do it on the level that Chris did it, that I love to do it, that good managers do it, you basically throw yourself into that artist's life, and it becomes part of your life. And I make a joke that artists wake up every morning and wonder what the world can do for them. It's a luxury that they enjoy. Like, what, I need this, I got to call this person, I got to do this. As a manager, you wake up every morning trying to figure out what do you have to do for the world to keep it moving. Mm-hmm. And so that will build up on you. That pressure can add to the stresses that you're carrying around. And you just sort of, you have to learn how to nurture yourself. And you don't really learn how to do that all the time, because the drive and the determination to get that next check, to make that next deal, is just, that's sort of what you know. You know, when you talk about Chris Lighty, Chris came out of Rush Management, which was Russell and Lior and you know, Public Enemy and Run DMC and all that stuff. And so he saw how it was done like that. And when he built Violator, you're talking about a man that built careers. There are managers that have built one career. You have managers out there that have done a great job with one artist. And I respect them, because that is no less of a challenge. But when you build multiple careers, when you take on the number of lives, personalities, and conflicts, different record labels, all those multiple times, and you do it time and time again, it's a talent. It's a talent and a work ethic that you know, people don't necessarily recognize. And as a manager, it's not your job to step up and wave your own pom-poms.
You know, it could be said that Chris Lighty was a genius in many ways, because he understood not only the street culture but also the corporate culture. He was a guy who could stand in front of a club with a bulletproof vest or speak the King's English in a meeting where he's going to broker a $1 million deal for his client. In working with him, what would you say his real talents were?
Identifying talent. Chris's talent was being able to identify, nurture, and cultivate talent, and his ambition. And so when you put those two together, the sky's the limit. When you can see in, you know, a Busta, when you can see in a 50, and you can see in all these other artists that Chris managed, and Missy, and all those that what other people might not have seen yet, and to know this is going to work. And then on top of it, you can see in a Mona Scott, you know, the executive that she would become, when you can see in just all the other executives that he groomed out of Violator. So it's not just that he managed talent. He was a groomer. You know, this man provided opportunities for people to feed their families. And so that, to me, is his. That was his.
He also evolved, because he started out as a manager, but then he broadened what it meant to be a manager by starting to take hip-hop into the corporate world and say, look, we can get some money over here, we can get some money over there. And he helped his clients evolve. I mean, look at 50 Cent. I mean, sitting down with him, you see his brilliance and his willingness to accept his responsibility to evolve through his platform and also through philanthropy. Did Chris contribute to that with his clients?
Yes, he took great pride in educating his clients on the world beyond just their music. It was important that he got them to understand that there's a world outside of your neighborhood. There's a world where you have responsibilities, where you need to see things besides just the club. And he took pride in opening those doors and putting them in rooms that they normally didn't even think they needed to be in.
Mm. And just to put things in perspective, he was a 44-year-old man, but for more than a decade, he was a millionaire. This is a Bronx kid, a black kid, who became a multimillionaire. And not only that, he helped create probably dozens of black millionaires and multimillionaires. That wasn't something that he ever, when you talk to him, took credit for.
But we talked, I remember, about the importance of helping his young clients seize their opportunity to not only become wealthy, but to stay wealthy. Why was this so important to Chris?
Because
I know you feel the same way.
Our story is similar because someone gave us that opportunity. The reality is that whether it was Red Alert, seeing the potential in Chris and going and making him the Jungle Brothers road manager, or it was Lior offering Chris a job to come and work at Rush Mandarin, or Shaquem Compare offered me to come work at Flavor Unit. It was these people saw something in us and gave us that opportunity, and it was our mandate. It's our duty to do that for others. You have to, it's each one teach one. You have to give back. It's not about getting in and I got in, I know how to do it. It was, I got in, who else can I get in, and who can I help achieve their dreams?
I want to read a statement that Russell Simmons put out, who worked with Chris early in his career. Bottom line, hip-hop isn't the same hip-hop without these black mentors showing kids the way. Black kids from black neighborhoods, usually polluted with poverty and violence, need mentors like Chris Lighty to navigate through the rough waters. What do you think he meant?
I think that when hip-hop started, when it was just Russell going through the door and he looked around, he didn't see other people that looked like him, he realized that he needed to bring people through, and that Russell, to this day, is still opening up doors to us that didn't know. Russell showed a lot of us about art. Russell showed a lot of us about fashion. And now you have this next generation of kids coming up where you don't have the same opportunities that we even had. The music industry is different. It's not, there was a period where we were just, everything was all good. We were all making money. It was like, hey, let's have a good time. But now the music industry is tighter. The finances are harder to come by. You got to work a little harder. And a lot of people are in survival mode. And when everybody's in survival mode, it's not as many people in mentoring mode. And I think what Russell was trying to say is that as much as we're trying to be in survival mode, don't forget the mentoring. Don't forget the nurturing. And I often say that as a manager, every uneducated manager in the game makes my life harder. Because if I'm trying to do good deals or good business, but then this person comes through and acts up, or his artist acts up, and I got to come behind him, that person now has that impression that that's what it's going to be like to do business with all of them. So it's my job, and Chris Russell's his job, to talk to the young manager, to tell him, hey, you know what, try it this way. You don't have to run into the building this way with a bomb strapped on you. You can run into the building ringing a bell or something just to get their attention. There's different ways to approach it, and Chris took pride in educating young managers and his artists just the different ways to rise above stuff.
And it was only in November when you and Chris came to discuss your merger with me. It was there that we got a glimpse not only of how committed Chris was to the business, but also how socially conscious he was, as we talked before. He was indignant, if not self-righteous, about the notion of black businesses working together and doing partnerships together. Let's take a look at what he said in that interview.
The coming together also is a good statement for our culture, because it's usually been the crab in the barrel effect, you know,
mm-hmm.
one African American not helping the other African American. So this is like the first time really showing unity. Imagine if Russell Simmons and Andre Harrell had did Def Jam Uptown together instead of doing them apart. You know, it could have been phenomenally the as big as Def Jam was, and I was part of that. But
yeah.
With Andre, it could have been absolutely bigger than Motown. I always say Def Jam was my Motown, but if those two people have gotten together, they're best of friends. So
right.
Why did they not do their company together? So we're thinking we'll provide more services, provide more opportunities for our clients.
And sitting at his funeral, you couldn't help but notice all the superstars that came in, all of the influential music executives who came in just to pay tribute to Chris. But while sitting there, it really occurred to me that when you look through, as all of these guys came, these guys are getting older. A lot of them in their 40s, some of them in their 50s. You guys really did it. You made hip-hop a cultural phenomenon. But there's a new generation coming behind that's got to keep it going. Who are they, and where are they?
They're out there. There's
you know, you got the Kendrick Lamar's and them on the West Coast that are trying to create their movement. I saw a period of music where there was a lot about me and stuff that went on, but I'm seeing movements now. Kanye and his Good Music movement. You have movements and you have these pockets that are trying to rise above the simplicity of what the game has sort of become. And when I meet, you know, Top Dog, who runs Kendrick Lamar, and they're all on the same label, and they're signed to Dr. Dre. When I meet a young brother like him, and I see in him, and I see the energy in him that you would see in when Puff had that energy. When you meet those, when you see an ASAP Rocky, when you see Future in them, and you see these young kids with the they still have that hunger that we had, like that we used to run through doors with. You want to, when you see them make mistakes, you want to be like, call them and say, hey, it's cool. That's all right. That's how you do it. And what happens a lot of times is we get into our own individual mousetrap and we're just running around. But until no one reaches out when you make a mistake. And Chris was a reacher outer. You know, I try and be a reacher outer, and I'm trying to do it more now without Chris here. I feel like I have to take on that responsibility to reach out. That if I see a young manager or somebody in some, let them know, hey, if you want to talk to you, you're not sure about it, that is okay. That doesn't mean I want your artist. It doesn't mean that, you know, I'm just calling because I may have been down that road. But there's a lot of young entrepreneurs that are trying to figure out and navigate their way through this new digital game that we live in. And they're making the rules as it changes. They decide that they're going to drop 3 mixtapes before they drop a label album and stuff like that. And that's how they keep themselves hot. They decide how they want to do it. And it's cool to watch. And Chris, to his credit, and I say this with the utmost respect for him, too, he stayed hip-hop. Chris stayed hip-hop. I've gone pop. When Outkast went pop and CeeLo went pop and everybody, I saw pop life, and I was like, hey, this is easy over here. I can do this. Chris stayed hip-hop. He had artists like Troy Oz and Uncle Mater and these young artists that he's bringing the artists in the label, in the office that he was excited about. And I'd be looking like,
all right. What's great about him was that he knew how to make a moment. When you looked at Think Back to 50, when he came out and he dropped a mixtape where he was just talking about everybody. Mm-hmm. He was ferocious. He was almost, they crafted this image of him where he was probably the most feared man in New York at that time. But by the time that album hit and he went on to sell millions of records, which paved the way for the Vitamin Water deal, this guy had everybody's attention. Chris did the same thing with Scott LaRock, as Lear Cohen said earlier on. He helped out, and when that came out, there was a feeling about criminal-minded on the streets that people had. Was his gift also marketing?
Oh, it was complete marketing. I mean, it was a complete grasp and understanding of hip-hop, hip-hop's current place, where hip-hop could go, how to get there. If this artist can take us there, can this artist take us this far? People forget, yes, Buster had Sprite commercials. Long before there were a lot, there were all these happy rapping commercials. You had Busta Rhymes and Sprite commercials. You had LL doing commercials. Like, Chris and them opened a lot of those doors for the first time you saw rappers in commercials. Chris did Drake's Sprite deal. I mean, Sprite deal with before Drake dropped his album. So he didn't believe that there was a glass ceiling in hip-hop. He didn't believe that there was any place that we couldn't go. And that opened so many doors that people just don't really even connect to him.
What kinds of deals were you working on with Chris, and what is the future now? What are you looking at and excited about for Primary Wave?
Continuing his legacy, continuing the plan that we had to bring in more managers. Like, my first thing is to, you know, protect the clients and make sure that they get through this and everything with heads up and keep their careers going. And then to bring in more managers. I can't replace Chris, but I can bring in a few managers out there that I believe get it, and I would love to bring them in and make the vision of us all working together a reality and complete that task that we started. And then, actually, it's funny. I see everything and anything. I don't really see one thing, because any one thing I know we can achieve because we've done it. So I see my clients on Broadway. I see clients in Vegas. I see clients having TV series. I see clients with restaurants. There's nothing that we can't do in hip hop because we've done it. It's just a matter of us thinking of it and then making it happen.
What is the message that you want to leave us with today?
Remember Chris Lighty as the visionary that he was, as the father that loves his kids, as a manager's manager, an icon. I said to that, said, you have to put a Mount Rushmore of hip-hop business people. Now, we can get into artists and who should be up there. I'm not going to get into that with you. But you would have to put Chris's face up there. You're going to have to put Russell's face. You're going to have to put Chris Lighty's face up there. You know, and then we'll fill in who else needs to get up there. And that's what people, I want people to remember about my partner Chris, about his legacy, about Firelator, and to build onto that and really continue to take hip-hop to new heights and to bring us also, bring us together, as well as I want to extend myself to brothers that may know me, may not know me, but might need to talk. You know, I've had the same phone number since 1995. I don't change my number. That's who I am. So it's okay to call and talk. It's sometimes we just need to just get it out of our system. And I think that more of us should do that. You know, we should reach out to our friends and make sure they're okay. And don't just let people brush it off like, yeah, everything's okay.
Right.
Sometimes you have to probe. Sometimes you got to push a little more than you make feel comfortable. But try and help somebody get through a rough time, because you don't want to be thinking, like I was last week, did I do enough?
Were there any signs, or did he ever say that he was struggling with depression or having a hard time at all?
I saw the look of a fellow manager with a lot on his shoulders. And so you wonder if, you know, could I have called and checked on more? Could I have done something? But that's me, how I'm thinking. I think that it was just the weight of what comes with the responsibilities. And Chris had broad shoulders, and he never ran from responsibility. So you carry that. He learned how to carry it. And so that's what I want people to remember, that those broad shoulders let a lot of people stand on them. A lot of people stood on Chris's shoulders to feed their families and improve their lives. And that's what I want people to remember about him.
And that's the question. Who takes care of the caretaker?
Yeah.
Lou Williams, thank you so much, brother,
for
coming in. I wish you the best as you continue to move forward. And come back, of course, and let us know about all of your business developments as they come along.
Thank you very much.
And with Lou Williams, I'm Lee Hawkins for the Business of Celebrity. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, that was my man Lee Hawkins from the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal. And so that was the Lou Williams Show. And a little information about his boy Chris Lighty. Tomorrow we're going to do a little program on Martin Luther King. Why don't you go in there and tune in to that. I'll see y'all tomorrow. Good night, everybody. And may your God be with you.
There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far, very far, over land and sea. A little shy and sad of eye, but very wise was he. And then one day, a magic day, he passed my way. And while we spoke of many things, fools and kings, this he said to me: the greatest thing you ever learn is just to love and be loved in return.
Turn.